my fellow music lovers, my music machines, the Panasonic Dynamite 8 that plays 8-track cartridges. It's a blast. Their terrific colors play on batteries and electricity. But what makes the Panasonic Taken Tape and Dynamite 8 so right is that they both sound like dynamite!
Well, hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Today, we're taking a trip down memory lane with another music format, one many of you may be familiar with but don't know the whole story. Today, we're sharing the history of the 8-track tape. The invention, the engineering, the problems it was trying to solve, the problems it created, and some of the music we have as a response to the constraints of this format. Many artists customized their music to fit into the 8-track format, including Pink Floyd, The Rolling Stones, and more. And today, we're going to share some of those details with you. And it's thanks to show sponsors GrooveWasher.com. If your records aren't clean, you're not getting the full sound. Get a GrooveWasher record cleaning system today at GrooveWasher.com. And we're also sponsored by Thorin's Turntables. Quality turntables made to last a lifetime. Ask your hi-fi dealer today about which Thorin's turntable is right for you. And now with that, let's change tracks and talk about the invention of the 8-track tape.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, thanks for joining us today. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, or today maybe we should be called The Magnetic Tape Guide, as we won't be speaking so much about records, but about the 8-track tape. Now, I know some people out there have a bit of a laugh when they hear about the 8-track tape. These days, the 8-track tape format, it seems very funny, odd, and amusing, but it was really the first time people got to take their music mobile. It really changed the way people listen to music and their expectations overall. No longer were people beholden to radio stations and whatever they chose to play. 8-tracks were the first mass-scale option that enabled people to manage and enjoy their music on the road according to their own wishes. Plus, some artists even saw the 8-track tape as a bit of an opportunity to sneak in a few extras, bits of songs you may have never known were out there. Artists like Pink Floyd, Rod Stewart, Fleetwood Mac, and more, there's extra music out there that was formatted by these bands just for the 8-track tape. So we're going to talk about those and play some of those for you a little bit later on. It's a pretty fascinating tale, the whole saga of the 8-track tape, and some very interesting characters involved. So I hope you guys enjoy the story. So let's get started right after we pay some bills, talking about our awesome show sponsors, Thorin's Turntables and GrooveWasher.com. As vinyl collectors, we put a lot of energy into our records, but many people don't put nearly as much thought into their turntables. And quite honestly, the turntable is a huge differentiator in the sound you get. Now, I've seen people play $40 records on an $80 turntable, and that there is a recipe for problems and probably ruining those records. Turntables are an investment, not just in sound, but the longevity of those records. So that's why I recommend people checking into Thorin's Turntables. Now, Thorin's has been around for over 100 years. Their first turntables were made for Edison phonographs, so they know what they're doing. Thorin's are Swiss-made and engineered with a high-quality audio experience in mind. And don't worry, Thorin's don't cost a fortune. There are many different models to suit all budgets. So check out Thorin's.com today, Thorens.com, or ask your hi-fi dealer about a Thorin's turntable. Thorin's, quality you can hear. Now, it's no secret that I use the GrooveWasher record cleaning system. I've spoken about them before on the show, and I use the product all the time. And that's because I'm a vinyl hobbyist, so I don't need one of those large record cleaning machines. I mean, I'd love to have one, and many of them do a great job, but they're $1,000 or more, and they end up taking up a lot of room. If I was a record store, a record cleaning machine would be perfect, but for the average record listener and vinyl collector, I've found the best bang for the buck is the GrooveWasher record cleaning system. A GrooveWasher comes with a specially designed brush designed to clean vinyl records, and they have a brilliant G2 fluid made to loosen and lift grime from deep within the record groove. meaning that your records are cleaner and sound their absolute best. You can get a Groove Washer record cleaning system today for less than $50 at groovewasher.com. It's what I use and what I recommend for the vinyl record hobbyist. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. Even though this is the Vinyl Guide podcast, I'm pretty clear that myself and likely majority, if not totality, of our listeners are fans of music first and fans of vinyl records second. After all, music is what led us to consuming records, and the format of the record would be considerably unexciting were it not for the wonderful music it brings us. We pass up records in garage sales and giveaways when it's music we don't find wonderful. However, when it is music we enjoy and are even moved by, we'll sometimes buy more than one copy. We're humans, and we're kind of weird like that. So today's tale isn't about vinyl records, but about another media format, a way that people purchased and listened to music not all that long ago. It's a format that has a smaller fan base than vinyl, likely due to the limitations of the format, but has a story that is every bit as interesting. I'm talking about the 8-track tape, a format that is often heckled and held up as an example of the ironic and the arcane. It's a simple technology, but it had a lifespan and a fan base longer and wider than that of many other inventions that we still hold in reverence. 8-track tapes were an eventual response to a problem that was recognized since the early days of recorded music. In the late part of the 19th century, there were competing formats for the audio market. Let's first start with wax cylinders, the weird forefather of what would eventually become the vinyl record.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who would have melody or be amused.
Invented in 1877 by Thomas Edison, the wax cylinder had limited fidelity and was used primarily for purposes of dictation. And even though they were using wax cylinders, the term record was coined because users would record their sounds. The technology worked by having a cutting head or needle carve grooves into a spinning wax tube, which were reproduced upon playback by a reading head. It is an almost identical approach that is still used in vinyl records today. It took over 10 years and the preferred formula of hardened wax and marketing to evolve into the pre-recorded record industry. Users could purchase cardboard tubes that held a wax cylinder containing approximately 2 minutes of audio. Buyers didn't get too much of a choice in music. Generally, they just ordered whatever genre the shop had, marches or speeches, things like that. There were almost no artists that had the sort of fame and stature that the public knew far and wide, so song or artist requests weren't that common. In fact, the song or artist was written on the lid of the cardboard tube, and there was no unique cover art. Each wax cylinder came in a cardboard tube that had the apparently constipated face of Thomas Edison.
No matter what may be your mood, I am always ready to entertain you.
Around this time, the Danish inventor Valdemar Poulsen developed a prototype for the wire recorder. The wire recorder used spools of thin steel to magnetize according to the pulses of audio that were converted into electricity. It used a magnetizing head to record audio onto the wire and a playback head to read those magnetic signals and reproduce the audio. It too produced such a low fidelity sound that it was really only practical for dictation purposes, in which the audio was just a simple voice recording and didn't require long-term storage.
A newcomer to the business world is the Pierce electronic wire recorder, designed to be used as a dictating machine. The dictator speaks into a microphone, and his voice is magnetically recorded on a stainless steel wire. The length of the wire is such that more than 2 hours of dictation can be recorded on a single spool. These spools of wire are later transcribed by typists who listen through earphones connected with identical machines. A turn of a switch will also give the dictator immediate playback. Corrections or changes in dictation are easily made by erasing and re-recording.
Over time, limitations were realized in both formats. Wax cylinders were just too bulky. They broke easy, they were finicky, they were difficult to transport. The wax cylinder format eventually gave way to the flat records, which we still use today. Those, of course, are easy to stack, store, and ship, and are much more durable, as evidenced by the many we have that have continued to last a century or more. Wire recording took a bit longer to evolve, as it found a niche in military purposes. However, its limitations were quickly apparent too. Wire recordings were impossible to reproduce on a mass scale. They were difficult to edit. When the wire broke, it was typically at such a tension that it made a big mess. The format of wire recording was eventually replaced by magnetic tape, a format that allowed for easy storage, recording, and editing.
So the next time somebody says to you, "What's a magnetic tape recording?" you can answer very glibly as follows.
Well, the microphone here picks up the sound from the source. In this particular case, the person speaking, the electrical impulses produced by the microphone are amplified by a suitable amplifier, which in turn is connected to what we call the recording head. Over this head passes the magnetic tape, and the magnetic recording head arranges the magnetic particles on the tape in a magnetic pattern corresponding to the signal from the amplifier. The reproduction of this tape is accomplished by passing the same previously recorded tape over a similar magnetic head, and the magnetic head reproduces an electrical signal from the tape, which is amplified and is subsequently connected to a loudspeaker, which reproduces the sound.
And with those evolutions, for several decades, records and magnetic tape lived peacefully side by side, rarely crossing paths. Even though they were both used for storing audio, they focused on different parts of the audio experience. Records were great for mass distribution of music, both songs and LP records. Consumers could buy a record to hear what the artist recorded and was the recipient of the audio experience. The market for the magnetic tape were people who enjoyed more control. Rather than simply listen to the music, they saw value in producing and managing it as well. With a magnetic tape recorder, you could take a blank tape and record all your favorite songs on it one after another. You could then erase it and start again once you got tired of those songs. Or you can connect the tape recorder to your radio and grab the songs directly from the airwaves. Or if you worked at a radio station, you could record the show, store it, or send it to other stations. It was much easier to produce a tape recording than cutting a record, and the tape generally lasted longer and could be played more than a record acetate. And although there was a bit of crossover, like recordable paper records or pre-recorded reel-to-reel tapes, magnetic tape was a format more geared toward industry and business, and the vinyl record was geared toward the consumer market. But one person saw the future of consumer magnetic tape machines, and lucky for us, this person was none other than Earl Madman Muntz. Earl Muntz was an American businessman, entrepreneur, visionary, and risk-taker. This was the way he was wired since the very beginning. At age 20, in his hometown of Elgin, Illinois, Muntz started his own car lot selling vehicles. Too young to actually execute the sale, his mother would have to sign the paperwork of all his auto sales on his behalf. In 1940, Muntz moved to California to start another car lot, and in the course of that, came across an opportunity. He was made aware of a dozen or so vehicles that were custom-made for customers in Asia, but were now undeliverable due to the outbreak of World War II. One of the vehicles he had was a custom-made Lincoln built for none other than Chiang Kai-shek. Muntz bought them all at bargain prices, and when local media got wind of these stories, Muntz sold all the cars for handsome sums. He learned early that odd stunts would encourage people to talk about his business, and he adopted the middle name Madman. And with that, Earl Madman Muntz went from salesman to sales personality and began to saturate Southern California with commercials.
May I help you, sir? You can see we have quite a selection of quality used cars.
We've got all kinds.
Most makes and models, and in all colors, and in all price ranges. Browse around as much as you'd like.
Muntz became so well known, he was often joked about by comedians on television like Bob Hope or Jack Parr, and his car lots became tourist attractions, all of which continued to fill his coffers. And luckily, too, Muntz was such a risk taker, he would often impulsively overspend to a dizzying degree. In 1948, he moved from car salesman to car manufacturer when he purchased the rights for a two-seater Curtis Craft sports car and quickly renamed it the Muntz Jet. The marketing for the Muntz Jet vehicle took on the same outrageous approach, offering speeds of up to 125 miles per hour, paint jobs with a name like Mars Red, and a full cocktail bar under the backseat armrests. Within the next 5 years, Muntz sold 400 Muntz Jets vehicles at a loss of about $1,000 each. In the 1950s, all the vehicles were sold at a loss, but today, Muntz Jets are highly collectible cars, often fetching several hundred thousand dollars apiece. However, while the Muntz car company was spiraling, the Muntz television company was thriving. Muntz led an effort to simplify the invention of television, reducing the number of tubes and parts, and producing a low-cost television set that appealed to the masses during a period of huge growth in the medium of television.
There's something about a Muntz TV in oh so many ways.
In 1952, the Muntz television company grossed nearly $50 million. Muntz was now a national figure, selling televisions across America and appearing in his own advertisements on national TV shows like Ed Sullivan, dressed in a Napoleon hat and acting nutty to further his madman persona. By the end of the 1950s, though, the Muntz television company was also in trouble, and creditors swarmed. Earl Madman Muntz was coming out of an exhausting decade of ups and downs. By 1959, he was bankrupt. His businesses closed, his name no longer in the national conscience, and at a low that would have crushed lesser men. But not Muntz. And that's when he became aware of the Fidelity Pack. The Fidelity Pack was a playback cartridge designed by George Eich, based on the design of an endless tape loop. It was a plastic cartridge that held a spool of quarter-inch magnetic tape, which could be cut into varying length. The strip of magnetic tape was divided linearly into two channels. One channel held the recorded audio, and the second channel were for tones that signaled the player to stop or recue the tape. Very simple contraption. This made the Fidelity Pack format ideal for radio stations, who required massive amounts of pre-recorded audio for commercials and announcements, and enabled them the flexibility of repeated play. Fidelity Pack cartridges became known as carts, and the cart system quickly became an irreplaceable part of thousands of radio stations worldwide for the next several decades. But beyond the limited use in radio stations, Earl Madman Muntz saw a bigger opportunity for magnetic tape cartridges. By the early 1960s, pre-recorded music was primarily distributed on vinyl records. However, you couldn't take your records on the go. In the post-war years, America saw an enormous leap in the percentage of car ownership, and the public spent more and more time and energy in their vehicles. The car culture of the United States grabbed hold. However, there still weren't any sustainable portable audio formats that would lend themselves to this huge market. There were a few attempts to develop a way to play vinyl records in the car, but that was just a recipe for disaster. One dashboard-mounted record player was from a company called Highway Hi-Fi and was designed by Peter Goldmark, an engineer formerly of Columbia Records, who helped develop the 33 and a third long play format. The Highway Hi-Fi car record player was doomed from the beginning, with the availability of units and titles restricted from the very start. For one, these players were an option only in Chrysler cars in the late 1950s, with no aftermarket availability for other car models. And to make the units even more frustrating, the Highway Hi-Fi systems used specifically designed music discs that only ran at 16 and 2/3 RPM, and again, only from Columbia Records, who had exclusive rights to produce records for this design. Talk about exclusivity. And the icing on the cake was that the units didn't even work well, and they required regular repair. After the industry had learned a few lessons from the Highway Hi-Fi debacle, other units attempted to break into the market by allowing standard records to be played in the car. However, again, records just aren't an optimal format for a moving vehicle. And these physics, along with the sun melting people's music collection along the Pacific Coast Highway, made the in-dashboard record players a bad investment for anyone. Earl Madman Muntz, out of work, ambitious, and a car nut himself, saw this mobile music as a great opportunity. But rather than records, he considered the Fidelipak cartridge concept as the answer and quickly developed an organization to serve this need, calling it the Muntz Stereo Pack. The Muntz Stereo Pack was a revolution for car owners who loved their music. Its design enabled them to practically make music portable and had many advantages over the failed record player in dashboard attempts. First off, the design was an endless tape loop with two stereo tracks moving in parallel. A moving playback head enabled the user to merely flick a switch to change songs. This allowed the driver to operate the audio without taking their eyes off the road while they were driving, a huge advantage, as you may imagine. The cartridges also allowed playback without fear of skipping, and buyers could take music with them without fear of warping or melting. The Muntz Stereo Pack was a hit from the very start, and he quickly opened several dealerships to install these units into cars. One such Muntz dealership was at 8801 Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, the exact location that eventually became the famous Tower Records on the Sunset Strip. The Hollywood dealership installed Muntz Stereo Packs into the vehicles of the rich and famous, including Frank Sinatra, Peter Lawford, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, and many, many others. Riding high, Muntz again began investing majorly in advertisements and rapid expansion, a recipe for his past successes and financial exposure. Everything seemed to be going okay until Muntz demonstrated the Muntz Stereo Pack system to another engineer, Bill Lear of the Learjet Corporation. Bill Lear was born in 1902 in Missouri, and from his early years showed an incredible aptitude for engineering and design. As a teenager, he found work repairing typesetting machines and rebuilding cars. He found a passion for this sort of work and eventually opened up his own repair shop while studying wireless, batteries, and rectifier tubes. Lear's knowledge, inquisitiveness, and ambition led him down a path of creation, which ultimately produced over 120 patents in his lifetime. His intellectual property naturally brought investors and buyers, which brought him wealth. In 1931, at the ripe age of 29, Lear purchased his very first airplane, and his passion for aviation and invention brought even more patents and developments, such as autopilot, and the very first automated aircraft landing system. The Lear Developments Company, soon to be Learjet, earned in excess of $100 million during World War II for its products. Lear eventually studied a small Swiss-developed jet, the FFA P-16, redesigned it for specialized luxury transit, priced them at about half of what similar jets were selling for, and had an immediate hit on his hands. And today, the Learjet is largely what Bill Lear is known for. What Bill Lear isn't widely known for are his improvements to car audio. After taking a ride with Earl Madman Muntz and hearing all about the glorious four-track Muntz Stereo Pack audio cartridge system, Bill Lear got to work on a series of changes to this design, including expanding the four tracks to be eight, which enabled four stereo tracks rather than the two on Muntz's design. And to make sure we're all on the same page, let's take a real quick nerd break to talk about the engineering details. When you're working with the medium of magnetic tape, space and speed are everything. The more space you have, the higher quality the sound, and the higher the speed, the more space you have. For example, if you have a quarter-inch tape traveling at 2 inches per second, it will cover twice the tape space as the same tape traveling at only 1 inch per second. This will result in a much more detailed transfer and have a significantly noticeable improvement in audio quality. The magnetic tape can also be divided into tracks via the horizontal space on the tape. The Muntz stereo pack enabled 4 mono tracks, or 2 stereo tracks, as each stereo track has left and right channels. The redesigned Lear audio cartridge format enabled the same tape width to have 8 mono tracks, or 4 stereo channels. This had a major benefit, effectively doubling the amount of music a tape cartridge could hold, but it also cut the quality down. So in theory, the new Lear 8-track tape held double the audio of the Muntz tapes, but the Muntz stereo pack had better sound quality, a detail that often got lost in the road and engine noise of the cars they were installed in. Earl Muntz also had a problem with return stock. His audio tape distribution model wasn't to have record companies manufacture and sell their own 4-track tapes, but for Muntz to actually license the music from the record companies and manufacture the tapes himself, a very risky endeavor. This put great financial exposure on Muntz, as his company would press up tens of thousands of tapes, but in the event they didn't sell, a large percentage of them would come back as returns. If an album was a success, Muntz made money. If it wasn't, he took a bath. Either way, the record companies still got paid, whether Muntz did or not. Muntz eventually had warehouses full of unsold stock that he'd paid the license and manufacturing costs, but he couldn't find buyers for. Add to that that Muntz sold all his 4-track players himself through his dealerships, which constrained his ability to put players out on the market. Bill Lear redesigned that business model too, striking up a deal with Ford Automobiles that made his newly designed 8-track audio player an option and eventual standard for cars that the Ford company sold throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
With Mustang options like front disc brakes, a stereosonic tape player.
This put thousands and thousands of 8-track tape players onto the market for consumers to seek out their favorite albums on tape. With these modifications in place, it didn't take long for the 8-track tape format to leapfrog over the 4-track Muntz stereo pack to become the default leader in the portable music market, a position it held for many years.
Radio Shack has a super half-price deal now on an 8-track car stereo tape player. Regularly $59.95, now just $29.95. You save $30 and get your choice of music wherever you drive. Put stereo 8-track players in 2 cars for the regular price of 1. Or buy 1 and have enough money left over for car speakers and your first tape. Get on the road to savings now with this sale-priced realistic 8-track car stereo tape player. Only at Radio Shack, a Tandy company.
In the early 1970s, when it seemed like 8-track tapes would be a winning format, for a while at least anyway, other advances were made on the 8-track tape platform, including quadraphonic 8-tracks. To understand that one, let's quickly go back to nerd mode again. Well, remember how we said 8-track tapes were a series of 4 tracks with 2 stereo channels each, left and right? Well, while stereo refers to left and right channels, another format known as quadraphonic was emerging. Quadraphonic is 4 channels, left and right front and left and right rear. This is similar to surround sound that many of us have in today's home theater systems. Quadraphonic allows the listener to hear sound not only move left and right, but also front and behind, which was quite revolutionary at the time and quite expensive. Audio systems in the 1970s were quite bulky, and adding 2 additional channels effectively doubled the size and the price of the equipment needed, not to mention the doubling of the potential points of failure. To play quadraphonic music, consumers needed a large specialist receiver with 4 output channels, 4 speakers, and then, of course, tapes and media to play. The quadraphonic version of the 8-track was called Quad 8 and used the same size tape and cartridge of an 8-track. However, because of the additional 2 channels of audio, required double the tape length. If the tape length went beyond the maximum that a cartridge could comfortably hold, the quad 8 version of an album would need to be extended to a second cartridge, doubling the cost of production and manufacture. It was a nice idea, but in the end, only people with significant disposable incomes could enjoy quadraphonic sound. Quad 8 8-tracks were the exact same design as their stereo counterparts, with the exception of a sensing tab that alerted a quad 8-track tape player when to treat the signals as quad or stereo. Think about it this way. If you put a quad 8 tape into a quad player, it would treat it as quad and play it correctly. If you put a stereo 8-track tape into a quad player, it would treat it as stereo and play correctly. However, if you put a quad 8 tape into a stereo player, it would have no idea what it is. It would treat it like a regular stereo 8-track tape and only play half the channels. So it all got a bit confusing, and the quad 8 format was phased out in about 5 years. However, there were some interesting side effects of the 8-track tape. Since it was really the first mass-marketed recordable media, this made an enticing opportunity for audio bootleggers and counterfeiters. Anyone with the means could get custom audio pressed up into 8-track tapes, so the market began to flood with X-rated stag recordings in a time when access to pornography was quite limited. Some people, with significant resources and low scruples, started duplicating top-selling albums onto 8-track tapes en masse and selling them at a discount to record retailers, bypassing any copyright, artist, or record label payments. There's even a famous story about Jerry Lee Lewis once finding a load of counterfeit 8-tracks featuring his music at a filling station. He promptly returned back to the filling station with a tire iron and smashed them all to bits. Ultimately, there were several key reasons why the 8-track format was doomed to fail. No ability to rewind. 8-track tapes used the endless tape loop function with a design that made rewind impossible. If you enjoyed something in the song and wanted to hear it again, you had to wait until the tape ran through its tape cycle, and you'd likely be hearing several other songs before that part of the track came up again. The tape design did enable fast forward, but that did come with some risks and never worked particularly well, often ending in tapes being pinched or stretched. My parents had an 8-track tape player with a fast forward button, and that was deceptive in that it just shut off the speakers and gave the illusion the tape was fast forwarding, when in fact it was just quietly moving forward at normal speed. Reliability. I remember as a child walking down a road near my house, and I would regularly find 8-track tapes on the side of the road with the tape strewn out, obviously thrown out of vehicles in frustration. 8-track tapes had several moving parts, and when things went wrong, the tape would often be destroyed. Whereas a record album is a single object that stays static with other forces needed to interact with it on its terms, the 8-track tape played this dance with the 8-track player and its moving parts, which, under subpar conditions, and honestly, the inside of a moving vehicle is a subpar condition, often the tape was the victim. Song bleed through. The audio channels were so close together on the 8-track tape that if a playback head was a little bit off alignment, you'd hear two songs being played at the same time. It would be absolutely maddening, and possibly the reason some of those tapes were flung from those cars all those years ago. Song arrangements were difficult for the artist. It was nearly impossible to have the song sequence on a record album the same as an 8-track tape. Artists had to rearrange the playing order on 8-track tapes in order to cater to the constraints of the format. Where a record breaks up the artist's album into two groups, side A and side B, 8-track tapes broke albums into four groups, which often meant the playing sequence of the record resulted in half a song on group one and the second half on the other. And this wasn't a smooth segue, mind you. It was very disruptive, as the mechanics of the playing head also had to shift, generally with a large ka-chunk in between them. Woo-hoo! So in order to avoid these disruptions, artists had to resequence their albums, often with jarring results, as the song flow that worked best for the 8-track tape format wasn't always the best for emotional continuity. However, there were some interesting side effects to the 8-track tape format that resulted in a few rare and interesting artist decisions. When sequencing their album Animals, Pink Floyd took the constraint and turned it into an opportunity. Most fans of the record album will know that Animals is bookended by two short acoustic tracks called Pigs on the Wing. When sequencing the Animals album for 8-track, Roger Waters decided to combine each of those tracks, add a bridge and a guitar solo, and turn it into a regular length song. What I'm about to play is the exclusive version of Pink Floyd Pigs on the Wing, only available on 8-track tapes distributed in the 1970s. This is a version that many of you may have not even known existed or have never heard before. Floyd weren't the only ones who used 8-track tapes to hide surprises. With the extra time on the tape, Fleetwood Mac decided to extend the fade of the song Goldust Woman by an extra 30 seconds. Aerosmith's big 10-inch record is even bigger on the 8-track version of Toys in the Attic. Multiple tracks on the Rolling Stones album Some Girls were extended, and alternate mixes used in the 8-track version. In fact, the 8-track version of the song Beast of Burden is a totally different take, and I actually quite prefer it to the album version. Rod Stewart even used the 8-track version of his album, Never a Dull Moment, to insert a hidden track, a cover version of the Jerry Lee Lewis song, What Made Milwaukee Famous.
What made Milwaukee?
The 8-track tape format had a slow death, starting its decline in the late 70s and concluding with what is debated as the final 8-track tape released from a major label, Fleetwood Mac's Greatest Hits, in 1988. Many later 8-track issues have become collector's items, including Stevie Ray Vaughan, Texas Flood, The Police's Greatest Hits compilation, The Singles, and one of the only box sets that had record, CD, cassette, and 8-track versions, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band Live 1975 to 1985. There have been more recent 8-track releases, however, but it's generally only for press and novelty, including the Melvins' Live at Slim's from 2000 and Cheap Trick's 2009 release, The Latest. And although 8-tracks are often remembered these days in less than favorable ways, they really do hold a place of honor and ushered in the portable music and media age. With the 8-track tape, people got their first taste of having a means of portable music. They could listen to their favorite music outside their homes. They were no longer beholden to the preferences of disc jockeys and radio station programmers. The people called the shots. And if they wanted to listen to Foghat Live on Highway 101 while coming home from work, then damn it, they listened to Foghat Live. The shame here is that 8-track tapes continue to break down. The elements inside the tapes were not built to last 20-plus years. So if you have any 8-track tapes lying around and you're interested in keeping them in a semi-functional state, you'll have to do some maintenance on them. Now, Luckily, there are several resources available online to show you exactly how to do this and even order the much-needed extra parts. Sites such as katestrackshack.com and 8trackheaven.com are great resources for pricing and assistance with your 8-track hobby. So that's the story of wax cylinders and wire recorders and Earl Madman Muntz and Bill Lear and 4-tracks and 8-track tapes and some of the unique musical finds within them. Now, do you have any collectible 8-tracks? If so, take a picture, post them to Instagram, and tag us at Vinyl Guide. We'd love to see what you have. Please feel free to share. So that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide, or maybe I should have called it The 8-Track Guide or The Obsolete Media Format Guide. Whatever it is, hope you had fun. Make sure to subscribe to us at www.thevinylguide.com. Join our Facebook community, facebook.com/vinylguide. And above all, till we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.